Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/filmwaxradio. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
This is Kevin Corrigan. You're listening to Filmwax Radio.
Hey, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio. This is episode number 382 of the podcast. I hope you're well. Hope you had a good holiday. I did. I had to go to Boston. If you're following me on Facebook, you probably saw a couple of my posts because I was getting ready. It was a kind of a spontaneous trip. I had to go up to Boston for the day. And I posted, if anybody's going up to Boston, I'm going, I'm driving. So if you need a drive up there, let me know. So no takers, but I had a pleasant drive nonetheless. And then I had to go to Long Island on Thursday, Thanksgiving Thursday. And like a good Jewish boy, I have family in Great Neck, Long Island. And then we did Thanksgiving there. It was very pleasant, very pleasant. And then on a Saturday, our family friends, who are our oldest friends in the world, they have a weekend Thanksgiving, so people who are traveling can come. And it's sort of like a group of people that want to be together, and they know they can't do it on the Thursday because, you know, family obligations come first. So they do it on a Saturday, and it's right outside Philadelphia. And so we went down there for that, and we had a great time. And it's a pretty quick drive. It's a pretty quick drive. We had a terrific time. So all said, lots of great food, lots of great family time, friends, all that. So it's my favorite holiday. I'll say that much. You know, I do have a kid, so you kind of get excited for them for, you know, Hanukkah and Christmas. But essentially, Thanksgiving has always been my personal favorite holiday. So welcome to this new episode of the show. We have a great show. Sam Pollard, who is a terrific filmmaker and editor of note. Sam has edited quite a few films for Spike Lee, in fact. He was really Spike's go-to editor throughout the 90s. In fact, if you look at his IMDb page, it really does start in 1990 with Mo Better Blues. And then he was there for Jungle Fever, Clockers, Girl 6, Four Little Girls, Bamboozled. I think that was maybe the last time they collaborated, which would have taken him. Yeah, that was almost everything Spike did in the 90s. Anyway, Sam is probably most known for being an editor, but he's also an incredibly accomplished film director as well of documentaries. And he has a new film out. It's called Two Trains Runnin'. And I saw it at the Woodstock Film Festival and really, really enjoyed it. In June of 1964, hundreds of college students, eager to join the civil rights movement, traveled to Mississippi, starting what would be known as the Freedom Summer. And that same month, two groups of young men made up of musicians, college students, and record collectors also traveled to Mississippi. Though neither group was aware of the other, each had come on the same errand to find an old blues singer and coax him out of retirement. And they eventually find Son House and Skip James, two of the legends of the American blues. It's a real fascinating story of convergence here. I think Pollard has done an outstanding job with this film. Again, it's called Two Trains Runnin'. So far, it's been at Full Frame, at Sheffield Doc Fest, and at Woodstock Film Festival, where I saw it, and many other festivals. And it is currently, as of last night, Friday, the 2nd of December, enjoying a theatrical engagement at the Metrograph Theater in New York City. You can go to the website twotrainsrunnin.com, leave off that G, and check it out. Check out more information about the film. But we're going to get into a conversation with Sam Pollard about the film. And it's great to have, by the way, Sam back on the show, because Sam was on episode number 232 back in 2014. And it was an interesting thing because if you listen to the episode, which was a great conversation, we spoke about old movies and Westerns because we talked about Sam's, you know, youth and his came up with his loving to watch Westerns with his dad, like so many other people. That was his part of his generation, you know. And then here now we're talking specifically about his making this film in particular. So it was really nice. But if you go back and listen to it, the audio quality on that earlier one is kind of funny because I had forgotten some of my equipment and I couldn't record with my typical equipment that I carry around. And so we used my iPhone and I just put it down and I hit memo. And, you know, that's what you hear. Anyway, this time it sounds a little bit better. Let's put it that way. After that, we are going to have a conversation with a film sales agent. And, you know, this is a guy, someone who is a friend, and his name is Bill Strauss. And, you know, he's in an unsung role because not many people usually mention the sales agent. You know, we talk about the filmmaker, we talk about the distributor, we talk about theater owners and the exhibitors of films. I mean, I do. But we don't usually talk about this one key role. And this is a guy who I think I have a special amount of a warmth of for because he chooses projects that are very specific. And he's a real, in a sense, his own, you know, champion of these independent films. He gets behind and he helps to find distribution, the best distribution deal he can. And he also helps the distributor find the right films for them. So he's working in a very unique role in the timeline of a film. And he was also happened to be one of the producers of Straight Outta Compton. So, you know, he seems like a natural for the show. So we're going to talk to Bill in the second segment. I just want to mention that, as most podcast hosts do, that, you know, I really do rely on my listeners to support the show in only the most minimum of ways. And what I guess what I'm asking you to do is, if you're listening right now, and if you have iTunes, if you're a subscriber of iTunes, please do go to the Film Wax Radio iTunes page and leave a star rating and a comment, but a star rating first, because as you know, if enough people were to leave star ratings, and if every one of my listeners, or almost every one of them, were to actually leave a star rating and maybe a comment too, because it's really nice to see what people think of the show, but if you were to do that, my show would be discovered by more people. And that would help me out tremendously. And so I guess what I'm asking, if you do listen to the show and if you do enjoy it, or if you get something out of it, it's been helpful to you on any level, please do help me out in that way. And you can also, by the way, keep in touch. You can go to the website, filmwaxradio.com, and email me through there. And you can also reach out through Facebook. Not only do I have a page under my name, but there is a Film Wax Radio page as well. And we're on Twitter. And we're on Instagram, so it's very easy to engage with me and with the podcast, and I get emails, you know, every day. I will get back to everybody who writes, by the way. I can't always accommodate. I try to. I've had lots of people contact me through that, through email, and I've had them on the show. It just sort of depends. It's not just a quality issue all the time. We have to have something to talk about. There has to be something I can see, something, a way that people can see the work that you've done. You know, if you reach out and just say, you know, well, here I am, I'm this earnest filmmaker or producer or some such, and I'm doing a Kickstarter. Well, you know, I certainly applaud it, and in some cases I can help in a little way, but not always, because, you know, frankly, I have to see the quality of the work where you're coming. I don't know what I just have to kind of understand it, and it has to make sense within the scope of what I do. You know, so if I get behind a Kickstarter, because I haven't gotten to the point where I just said no more, but if I'm going to help you with your Kickstarter or your Indiegogo or whatever your, you know, fundraising mechanism is, I kind of have to have a relationship with you or with your work in order to get behind it. So just understand that too, when you're reaching out about that. And it's I understand, it's a great way. You know, there are thousands of people listen to the podcast, and, you know, to talk about your project on here is I'm sure quite helpful. So only too happy to help if it makes sense, and certainly want to help just about everybody who's doing something that's artful and authentic and meaningful, because that's what really this podcast ultimately is about. All right, show number 382, Sam Pollard, filmmaker, editor, NYU professor. Here it is, my conversation with Sam Pollard.
When you look at the stretch of coincidences about the trip and what happened afterwards, it reads like a very badly written novel. Who would believe it? In those days, we were the only ones who knew about these people. It was like being in a secret society. You know, now Robert Johnson's been on a postage stamp. But at that time, you know, it was just, who?
They were caught up into something they didn't understand of the struggle that was going on.
We can see what's happening in this country wherever segregation breaks down.
Loud! Did you hear me?
Blacks were being denied the right to vote and their basic rights as citizens. And those blacks who were making a stand or trying to make a stand were dying. They were being killed.
The country couldn't see itself in all those murders that were happening. Well, how do we get the country to actually take a good look at itself?
Well, this beats last time. Do you remember what happened last time?
I remember.
Yeah. I forgot. I actually had everything, but I think I forgot either the mics or the cords or something.
Yeah, you didn't have something. I forgot. Yeah.
And then we ended up, or maybe I had everything but the recorder.
You didn't have the recorder.
And, yeah, so I had the mics.
Yeah.
So we did it on the iPhone. So
that's right.
It's okay, man. It's all right.
You got one of these cookies, you know.
I don't want any cookies. I just want to give Jacob another one. So
I'll
just,
give Jacob, you know. Tell Jake to take one of these.
Yeah? You sure?
Yeah.
They're really good. You should try it first because you may decide.
No, I don't need to eat with so many.
Oh, no? All right. Hold on one second.
Jake.
Hello.
Have a cookie, man.
Here you go, Jake. Thank you, Sam. Sam Pollard back on the podcast. Thank you.
My pleasure, Adam.
Here at the Big Cheese. Is that the name of this place? I think it's called the Big Cheese here in Rosendale, New York. Next door to the Rosendale Theater, where you just had a screening of your new documentary, and it's called Two Trains Running. We'll get to what those two trains, what they mean, but we'll just be glad that Chris Christie wasn't overseeing those two trains. Otherwise, they probably would have derailed and killed countless. It's like, and then I was also thinking this is a really timely movie, although it's coming out just days after the election, isn't it? Theatrically, right? So we'll have.
That's right.
So when people hear this,
it'll be like a month after the presidential election.
Right, it's in December, so we'll have a new president by now, and we'll just go with our gut on this one.
That and we should send whoever the president is a copy of the film.
It does feel very timely, you know.
Yeah.
In terms of what's come up over the last few years, and specifically, it seems like it's been heightened by this election cycle. And then on the other hand, this film is Two Trains Running is also just real, just entertaining. It's a lot of great performance.
Yeah, I think what makes it special, you know, Adam, is the fact that it's both an important historical document, but it's also an important musical document.
Yeah,
you know, so we're looking at civil rights history, but we're looking at it through a musical lens, and the lens of the importance of the blues. Something that when I was a young man, I disregarded because I thought it was ancient and old.
The music part?
The music part. But, you know, as I've gotten older, I've become a real person, a person who's really learned to appreciate the music, the blues, people like Son House and Skip James and Mississippi Fred McDowell, all those great blues musicians.
And there's significance in the timing of that they were rediscovered, which is what the film uncovers, this period of time between 1960 and 64.
That's exactly right.
Which is a significant period because I was born in that period of time, as was my sister. And there's a key moment late in the film where, or midway through the film, where the kids that were going, these white, primarily white kids were coming down, college-age kids were going down looking for these lost blues musicians and were, in one case, mistaken for civil rights workers, which probably could have cost them their lives.
That's right. They were in some ways naive about what was happening politically.
Going on right concurrently. So the two trains of the title, one train is the civil rights train and the other train was this revival.
It's the revival and the search for the music, for these legendary blues musicians.
Which it was a sub section of the folk revival.
Exactly.
It was part of the same thing.
That's right.
And so that integration you know, of the white folk music and the black folk music coming together at you know, probably at the height at the festival, the folk festival, at the Newport Folk Festival, was in a way just like it almost seems like as powerful as any other, you know, moment in civil rights history. It seems like, you know, it's just, it was this incredible convergence was occurring.
Well, that's what makes this film so special and so unique, yeah, is this convergence.
Right.
The fact that in 64, this really seminal summer, that a group of young white kids would go down south to help fight for voter registration at the same time as another group of young white guys, yeah, both from the East Coast and the West Coast, we also go on this journey to search for two musical legends who are basically symbolic of the evolution of the, you know, the primacy, the primal age urgency of this music that was the blues, mm-hmm, you know, and searching for these guys. And it's, you know, oh.
Oh, thank you. More cookies. He's going to be, he's, I'm sorry, Sam.
That's all right.
I should mention, I came to the Woodstock Film, we're at the Woodstock Film Festival.
Yeah, we're at the Woodstock Film Festival with
family,
Adam and his son.
And my son is here too, my producer. And we're enjoying some refreshments after
so
your
when
screening.
He said daddy,
I know,
maybe think of my own son.
How old is your son?
Well, my old son's older, but when he said daddy, I'm a
it's
dad.
It's wired. It's hardwired into you, right? Yeah. Thank you.
So it's really just—it's really just fascinating to, mm-hmm, to work on a film that basically focuses on two areas that I have grown to love, both civil rights history and musical history of America, mm-hmm, and the musical evolution of the blues and the impact and the importance of the blues and how it sustains itself from the 20s to 30s, the 50s. Kind of lost some steam in the late 50s,
right,
but then came back in the 60s and the 70s, as you know, as we all know, when people in groups like Sun, you know, Rolling Stones and...
Right, the British Invasion.
Yeah, you know, and Eric Clapton and Jack,
all
you
these
know,
guys, right.
Ginger Baker, these guys all fell in love with the music. It helped revive it. Helped to make people's names like Howling Wolf and Muddy Waters,
sure,
you know, mm-hmm, become popular again.
Right, no doubt. And it was that double-edged sword there. On one hand, there are the critics who say these guys made millions of dollars off of there. This is, by the way, the film really doesn't explore, that's been explored quite a bit. So
it's
your film
explored.
Doesn't really focus
no.
on that so much. But it is a byproduct of the time where these guys were criticized. On the other hand, well, they really loved the music and they let people know and they gave credit where credit was due. And then
right.
they brought these guys out of retirement too onto major concerts
and got their careers back on
and their money too. Back in their pocket.
And as Dick Waterman said last night at our screening that we had at the New York Film Festival, you know, one of Skip James's songs was done by the Stones. They made sure that he got the royalties for it,
mm-hmm,
which was like about $80,000, you know,
yeah,
which is amazing.
Right.
Because someone asked a question about reparations for these blues musicians. And Dick said the important thing is to understand the publishing rights of all these songs. If people understand who had the publishing rights, the money that comes out of that publishing can go back to all these musicians or to their estates,
mm-hmm,
you know, to make sure that they get compensation for, mm-hmm, what they've given to the country and to the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Something that is being discussed, or is that something that's happening, or is there a movement to?
I think Dick has always
publishing
been
reparation, or
Dick has always been pushing the fact that people need to recognize financially these musicians who gave us this music, the Sun Houses, the Skip Jameses, the Mississippi John Hurts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a responsibility for these younger blues musicians, the Jack Whites and all of those, to basically stay true to that attitude.
Yeah, the commitment. Another thing the film doesn't explore, and then we should... We'll get right back on topic,
yeah, yeah,
but I'm curious to know if you there was almost a suggestion in the Q&A. Was there ever any whiff of paternalism or resentment? Because initially it's like, oh, you brought us out of you found these guys were sort of rediscovered. The film really explores in detail how Skip James and Sun House in particular were found. You know, they had long since given up music, and in the case of Sun House, he hadn't picked up a guitar in many years, right?
Many years, like 15 years.
Yeah, wow. But And then, you know, I took back to it really in a very, you know, significant
way.
But is there ever any, I mean, you said, there was also came up that, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that Skip had a certain amount of arrogance. I don't know. You know, I don't see it. But maybe that might have reflected on, maybe that could have come back in a way of also that there is a taint of paternalism, you know, again, with the white guys saving these older black guys.
Well, you know, I think most of the older black musicians, particularly someone like Son House and Mississippi John Hurt, they were very happy to be revived, to have their careers come back, you know, to get some money, you know, to get their music recorded again, to get their music heard again. Skip, on the other hand, was a much more arrogant and aloof man. And even Dick said last night, he didn't really like, he didn't think that his contemporaries were as good as him.
Yeah.
He didn't have much respect for his son or Mississippi John Hurt. He thought his music was the best music. So he probably, of all of those musicians from that time, what I know, probably felt the least
grateful
to these guys bringing their music back. Dick even said last night that either when Cream recorded one of his songs and he had listened to it, he thought they completely bastardized his music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Bastardized his music. So of all the musicians I've heard about, he's the only one that didn't seem to be you know, genuflecting.
Tripping over himself.
Say, oh, you guys done me such a great service.
And it's sort of beside the point because it doesn't take away from what he contributed at the end of the day. So, you know, there's this, you know, almost idea that they should be happy and put on a face, you know.
It's
amazing they're not more angry.
Probably were, but they didn't probably want to vocalize it, some of those guys.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the Wolves and maybe Muddy, they might have been a little more angry because they were younger guys.
Right.
You know, who knows?
Right.
That'll be quite honestly, that'll be another film. Someone will find those tapes, those audio tapes.
Yeah, the cuts. So the political side of it, because we've been focusing on the music, but... there's also this the film, again, it's called Two Trains Running, and it weaves together these two different concurrent things that were going on in the country at the time.
Dave Dennis said last night, what's important to remember, that even with the deaths of Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, it was really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what was going on in Mississippi. He said there were 19 other civil rights workers killed.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, during those years.
Were they interracial groups in the sense
he didn't tell, he didn't say that.
Because that might have been one of the reasons why this particular incident
provoked as much outrage. It did. That's why it did provoke that much outrage. But he was saying there were 19 others who were killed.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. It was about voter registration and change in the political structure.
I knew I was making a contribution to something much bigger than myself.
We are not going to permit any outside group to come into this state.
We were quite aware of the danger that the volunteers be coming down would be facing. Whites, they'd be faced with the same danger as the blacks who live there.
It was tense, and we drove into this.
If there was any chance of these people still being alive, it was worth whatever effort we had to put in to get them in front of a microphone again.
It's like Bigfoot hunting. There was so little information for them to go on.
It doesn't matter if you're looking for blues artists or if you are trying to register voters. You are an outside agitator.
We had no plan B. We had no backup.
We were going against such odds, trying to do such impossible stuff.
Understand that I was making a contribution to history.
My life has never been the same since.
Just think of how dangerous it was for these young people to go down there to fight for voting rights, to fight to break the back of segregation. You know, I applaud all these young people who went down there, white and black.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just 2 years ago when we were down shooting some of those interviews that's in the film, we were down Jackson, Mississippi for the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, you know. And a lot of those people, they're in the film, they're at that anniversary, you know, because it was, for them and for us, for the country, again, it was one of these most important moments in American history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you see that footage of Fannie Lou Hamer at the Democratic Convention, that is a powerful visual moment, you know. The fact that the Mississippi Democratic Party was trying to get themselves seated at the time at the convention, which was primarily run by Southern Dixiecrats.
Mm-hmm.
It's very powerful.
The Summer Freedom Project, that was a movement. It was a project to send young college-age volunteers down south to recruit people to vote. I mean, what was...
To basically empower black people and organize black people.
To organize.
To register to vote.
Right, okay.
To register to vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it was a way to politically empower us, you know.
Right.
And
the laws have been passed,
but there's Jim Crow. I know that even though we had been given the right to vote, you know, the white Southern infrastructure always had ways to kind of stop people from registering to vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, were you able to read this? Could you answer these questions?
There's a litmus, right?
It was a litmus test,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so this was people like Dave Dennis and Bob Moses and other people from SNCC and CORE, mm-hmm. an organization called COFO that was down in Mississippi, that were basically saying, we're going to be the front line. We're going to be the troops that working with the people in the community, you know, to get black folks to register, you know.
It seems, again, we start off saying how timely the film is, and of course there's all too obvious a parallel going on to this day, you know. Is that something that was in your mind at the time when you were formulating this documentary?
What's happening today in America was always in the back of our heads, right?
Yeah.
But as we started to put the film together in the editing room, particularly, you know, with Ferguson happening, mm-hmm. Mike Brown being killed, we started to say, we got to be able to speak to that too in this film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had been interviewing people, and even you can see in the interviews, we were asking those questions. You know, so we felt that as responsible filmmakers, we could not make a film without speaking to what was going on today. And just think, we finished the film almost a year ago now.
Okay.
And the country is still a boiling pot, you know. And this stuff is so relevant. With this election, you know, with Trump announcing that if he loses, you know, it's going to be voter fraud. I mean,
oh, he's getting ready for the rigged up reasons of his failure.
With the continuing murders of young black men and black women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the hands of the police.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it feels like flashback to 1964.
Yeah. I mean, it's odd because, you know, 8 years of Obama, I mean, it can definitely feel like it's like a simmering thing for those who resent the fact that we have a president of color. And then you get somebody like Trump, and it's a perfect storm for that resentment now to be unbridled.
Bubble over.
And so maybe that's an explanation for it. And then there's just the fact that everybody has a smartphone and is shooting these incidents that have been going on all over the country now, whereas maybe prior to Obama, we didn't all have the phones on us 24/7.
You know, my take on it is this, Adam. Obama becoming the first president, first African-American mm-hmm. president of the United States. There's a certain population.
Yeah, well, fortunately now it's been closed, this issue of whether or not he was an American. Unfortunately, thanks to our
yeah.
our elect-
But think about it.
Yeah.
There was a group of people in this country.
Yeah.
The idea that a man of color is president of the United States is anathema. It's a horrific thing. So it was a pot that was boiling. Mm-hmm. And you're right. All they needed was Donald Trump to stand up and say all the things he says
mm-hmm.
to let it go pop.
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah. It's okay to feel that way. That's healthy.
You can feel like you want to feel.
Yeah.
I don't
take that. Take that. Those feelings that you're not, you know, that you're sort of sitting on, and let them out. It's kind of the message.
Yeah.
At the having those rallies and
yeah. It's, oh yeah.
So it speaks to that. This film, in a way, it does speak to that.
Yeah.
You know.
You know, it's. I've been around a long time, Adam, and it amazes me how history constantly continues to repeat itself.
Mm-hmm.
Amazes me. Now, I'm 14, 15, and 64 and 65, and I'm a New York kid looking at this stuff happening in the South, and I'm thinking, whoa, will America ever get better? I go into the 70s and the 80s and my 20s and 30s, and I want to assume that America's getting better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in some ways, it has gotten better,
mm-hmm.
but in some ways, it's like it's taken a back. It's like Dave Dennis was saying last night,
mm-hmm.
It's sort of backslid. You know, into a way to, because people want to believe that, you know, people who are supporting Trump want to, they have this fictional belief that they want America to be what they thought America would be.
The great, yeah, return to yeah. The great days of America.
The great days of America.
It's so barely coded. It's so barely coded.
But, you know, yeah. It's never going to be that way.
No.
It's never going to be that way again.
No. You know, no, because the minority is now the
it's gonna
majority.
Be the majority.
Right.
You know, it's never going to be that way. People are going to have to.
You can just embrace it. It's so much easier.
You got to embrace it.
It's just so much easier to live without. Yeah. You know, I've talked about that a few times. It's just easier not to have hate. It's easier to get through the day. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
You know. So and so you premiered with the film at the New York Film Festival, or is that just your New York film?
That was our New York premiere.
Okay,
New York
pardon
film
me.
Festival.
So where did
it premiered in April at the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival.
Okay, in the South. Yeah. So that was my question. Yeah. Well, it's a film festival crowd, so it's a little bit of a bubble.
They
it's a little bit of a bubble.
They
of course,
it.
Yeah.
They love it.
You're preaching to the choir, so to speak.
Yeah.
But has anyone seen it? I don't know. There are probably people from the community.
It's
going to
be screened this week and tonight in New Orleans.
Oh, right.
It's going to be screened next week in Austin, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to screen next weekend in Chicago. It's screened in Denver, Colorado. It was in Vancouver a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
I screened it in Milwaukee mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago. It's amazing. It's really been getting a very great run. Everybody's embraced it. It's mm-hmm. you know, it's like
you made a popular film.
Yeah, but you know, it's amazing thing about documentaries. You work on these things, and you wonder if anybody will ever take it.
Right.
And initially, when we finished it,
mm-hmm.
when we were close to finishing it, we submitted it to Toronto. We submitted it to Sundance. We submitted it to South by Southwest, Berlin. Turned down.
And then your hopes kind of start to sink.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Full Frame. Came to the
deal.
Rescue.
Right. That's great. And the New York Film Festival, that's not bad.
That was like...
Yeah.
Hey, man. I got to say, that was...
In your
that's
hometown.
Special.
Yeah. Your
that
hometown,
was special.
Your hometown festival. I was going to say, Full Frame. And then... damn, I hate losing my train of thought. But... now I remember. There's so much music in the film, so... Can you have a soundtrack? Can you release a soundtrack?
Well,
how does that work? It's sort of
yeah. You know, Ben is working on that. He's trying to get a soundtrack.
Who's
together.
Ben?
The producer,
okay.
Ben Hedin.
Ben
the
Hedin.
Producer.
Okay.
Is working on that now, trying to get a soundtrack of the music done by Lucinda and Gary.
Oh, the contemporary. We should say there's interstitial
contemporary
blues musicians.
Besides having the soundtrack, they would have both Sunhouse and Skip's music. We'd also have the covers,
right.
By Gary Clark Jr.
Yeah.
Lucinda Williams, the North Mississippi All-Stars, Buddy Guy, John Mooney, you know, Valerie June, all those other wonderful
great.
Musicians.
Yeah, a number of them, or all those names maybe, were performing throughout the...
They're performing
throughout
music
the,
of Skipping and...
Yeah,
Sun.
No, these are clearly the grandchildren or children of these guys, and the sense of the, you know, continuing the lineage of blues music and...
Yep.
And in that, too, we talk about things in a circle. Things don't go away. A lot of it negative. But also, same in a positive way, the music keeps coming back.
Always.
So there's that, too. There is in the cycle of things. There's the hate that keeps coming back.
And the love.
But there's also the love, the good
that's
music
right.
that keeps
both.
Coming back.
Both.
I mean,
but
it all sounded so fresh. And I have to say, one of the freshest pieces of music, not just these more contemporary musicians you just named, but also what there's also one audio performance or performance from a workshop, I think, that was happening at the Newport 64. I think it was 64. You can correct me. Skip James, which had me in tears. I mean, it was so powerful. His voice just sort of cut through. His beautiful tenor. I'm not sure if it was a falsetto. Somebody said it was falsetto. I think of it more as just his tenor, like
original.
A tenor. Yeah.
He's an original. Man.
I didn't know. I didn't know what an incredible voice
great material.
So beautiful and So he has a right to be a bit arrogant, you know, if you have that voice. And also, there's something transcending that happens when you see the clip of Sun House. There's the description of when he just, you know, when the kids find him. You know, it's a funny story because they chase after him all over the South and Mississippi.
He's
in Rochester, New York. They finally get up to Rochester, find him this block. They find the building. They go to some old guy hanging out in front and ask him, does Eddie House live upstairs? He goes, yeah, but he is not home right now. Oh, and they're all like rolling their eyes. Where now? Because I'm him.
That's a great
And then
touch,
they right? get him inside and they give him a guitar and he hasn't played in
15 years,
as you said. And he looks down and then you cut to a clip of him. And and it's like, geez, what a performer.
Yeah.
You know, like, anyway, so it's no wonder the roots of rock and roll start with these guys.
With that music.
It's the attitude. It's the, it's their, the performance. They were great. I don't know if it was intentional, but their performers, their performances were really something. I mean,
they're
not just their voices.
They're
all
original, man.
They invented it. So it's not like they were copying anybody. There was nobody
Everyone
before.
Everyone has their own unique approach to the music.
Yeah.
That's what makes it special.
Yeah. And this is the week where Bob Dylan gets the Nobel Prize, by the way, which I think is fantastic at 75, you know. I think it's true. Nobody before Dylan kind of did what he did either.
Let's hope when he accepts the award, he does a shout-out to these great guys.
There you go. And I hope that he revives his career, the poor guy. He hasn't stopped performing in 55 years. Anyway, thank you very much. We're having, by the way, when you hear this, it'll be probably just a couple weeks, I'm assuming, from the timing of my posting this. I'm going to
Metrograph
theatrical, which is going to be in
December 2nd to December 8th.
Very good.
Unless we get a lot of audience and we get held over.
And if I'm really lucky, I'll be able to get Peter Gromick. Maybe I'll try to get...
Good.
Because, as I said, he's going to be introducing or doing a Q&A with you,
Maybe you can also do...
the answer is yes.
Do an over-the-phone thing with Dave, Dennis, and Dick.
Sure.
And Phil Spiro's in San Francisco.
Sure.
You should try to... You got Ben's email,
Then I could do
right?
a whole... I don't know that I do. I might.
I'll send you Ben's email.
Okay. Because then I could do a whole episode and do a few sets, one with you, one with those guys, and maybe one with Peter.
Yeah.
And do it real, although...
And do one with Ben, too,
mm-hmm.
Ben Nadine,
producer of Two Trains Running, directed by Sam Pollard. Yeah.
Thank you very much,
Thank
Adam.
You. For you, the listeners of Film Wax Radio, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, I take a lot of car rides myself, long car rides on the weekends or to work, and I have become very, very addicted to Audible myself. Two titles, for instance, that I recently downloaded was Roger Corman, a prior guest of the show, what's called Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers by Beverly Gray. And also a former guest, William Friedkin. He has his memoir called The Friedkin Connection, two great titles. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/filmwaxradio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/filmwaxradio for your free audiobook. I would see Bill Strauss at any number of film events and screenings and parties and other kinds of film-related events. And I would always say, who is that guy? And we always kind of give a smile and say hello, but we don't know each other until two films were coming around that were two filmmaker friends of mine who had relationships with him and specifically around their projects. And they're both like, you should talk to Bill Strauss. You know, so 80 Cal, though, he said it, and also my friend Max Heller, and they both have new independent films, and they're working with Bill. And so finally, I was like, you know, you're right. The show, it works on different levels, one level is that of talking to as many people on the spectrum of filmmaking as I can. And I'm a long way off still. Trust me, I know that. But you know, I've spoken to distributors, and I've spoken to, you know, cinematographers and editors, and I've spoken to musicians who score films, and I've spoken to like thousands of directors and filmmakers and actors. But I have not spoken to a sales agent. And Bill Strauss is more than just being a sales agent, but this is an interesting thing to find out, because I didn't know. I don't know all and I found out quite a bit of information that really opened my eyes about what his role is and how, you know, sensitive and important it is. And so I was very happy to talk to Bill. And as we're going into Sundance 2017, and they just announced the slate just this past week, it's interesting to know, to see this is the timing where somebody like Bill, things pick up quite a bit. So, you know, that's why I'm posting the show this week. So here's my conversation with Mr. Bill Strauss. Bill, good meeting you, or good again. Sitting down with you. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you've had the experience whenever you go to, like, lots of festivals or, you know, film of functions, and you just see certain faces over and over.
Yeah.
And then after a while, you feel like you know them, but you don't really know what they do.
But you know nine people who know them well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You just keep seeing people. So you're one of those guys that I kept seeing, and I'm not sure what you did exactly, and then introduced, I'm sure, a couple of times by people, maybe like, I don't know, mutual friends. This most recent time, I mean, my friend Max Heller is a friend of yours.
Yeah.
And he's just wrapped on a film and called me with it.
Yeah.
Which I think I have an associate producer credit on that film.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think I helped with everything, maybe like setting up the lawyer and getting some other role, but I think the only person I didn't help find was a salesperson, the sales agent.
I like Max. I want to like it. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm going to take a look any minute.
Yeah.
I want to like it.
I know. Yeah. I know. You must have that sensation quite a bit because.
Yeah, but, you know, when it's a friend, it's more pronounced.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because how it can be complicated.
Yeah.
By the way, for those listening, Dad, Aunt Cindy, Uncle Joel, and everybody else, we're sitting out in the back of the building here where I live because Bill Strauss, for those who don't know, besides being a very successful sales agent and film producer,
thank you,
is allergic to cats. So that was not the perfect spot. We have a cat.
Cute cat, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she is. And she's turning, she's also up there. She's also like getting up there. My dog is 14 and my girlfriend's cat is, I don't know, somewhere around there too.
Yeah.
But they both look pretty good. Anyway, so, but you were saying, we can, I guess, move on because you know, I understand the nature of this type of thing. It may be the kind of thing where you're saying, you know, it might be good policy not to even work with friends. In your case, because...
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I've done it before. I might not have. You know, I tend to become friends with the clients, though. That's sort of my MO a little bit.
But that's different, because you've gotten behind the film. And you've worked with them and collaborated, so it would make sense that you'd become friendly with them, you know, and have an ongoing relationship. And also, you might be able to be in a position where, because you've gone out of your... you've produce so much for them, that maybe if the next work is more flawed, you could have the space to say it and to be more constructive with your, you know, you could say this isn't really the, you know.
Yeah.
It's, however.
I've actually had the opposite now that I think about it. Mm-hmm. A guy who's who was my best, I was his best man in his wedding. Mm-hmm. His brother-in-law did that. Is it okay to say who it is? You remember Notorious Mr. Bout? That was
Mr. Boot.
Mr. Boot, yeah, that was at Sundance a couple of years ago.
Sure, I do. That was Max's film. Max, he's half the director.
Oh, Max was involved in that. I forgot.
He's half
about
the direction
that.
Director.
I
team.
Completely forgot about that. But the director is a guy I've known for I don't know 15 years because he's the brother-in-law of the guy who. Mm-hmm. Who I was his best man, who I grew up with. So, okay. So in that situation, I almost felt like I was family.
Is that
Mike
Lerner?
No, Tony Gerber.
Oh, okay. Mike Lerner co-directed. I'm getting them all confused. I remember I think he'd worked on a project with Max's project before that.
I feel like that name's familiar to me, but I don't think I know him.
I think it was, unless I'm mistaken, the Pussy Riot, you know, film.
Oh, okay, cool.
Anyway, then I digress. So,
but that one I felt. Like a little bit like, wow, that's almost family, mm-hmm. you know, and that, like, I don't want to, you know, there's something, like, so I don't, you know, that makes me, like, a little gun-shy about it. And then, like,
right.
a bigger sales agent ended up taking it on, and I was kind of like, well, maybe I should have wanted that, you know. And
well,
I don't think I would ever had a chance at it anyway, but.
That's always a pitfall, though, if you turn something down for personal reasons.
It was never, I think we had, like, kind of, like, almost a... very informal conversation about it, you know.
Yeah.
So
it's like when it's sort of like when you hear how, you know, I don't know what actor would be a good example, but how maybe it's like almost a second tier actor turned down One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. You know, I'm not going to do this. This looks stupid. This is not. Nobody's going to do this. This is going to be a disaster. You know, that kind of thing. And whatever.
It was a little bit more like the weird, like, I don't want to disappoint their whole family.
Oh.
You know, like.
Sure. Well, that's understandable.
Yeah, like, I'm almost like a extended family member, and that's too much pressure. And then the bigger guys took it on, and I was like, shit, maybe I should. And then it got into Sundance, too, also. So that was good.
Yeah.
But he's you know, it was a good movie, too. But,
You know,
I think they did okay with it, too. I'm trying to remember who picked it up.
The Notorious Mr. Boot?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a fascinating story about this. Was he
was like a Russian businessman who.
But he ended like he was doing all this illegal sales of.
Eventually.
Like, okay. Yeah.
It was sort of like his how his businesses grew and grew and grew.
Right. And then he was arrested.
And guns eventually were one of the businesses,
Right. Gun running.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, one of your roles is as a sales agent, as I said, I think. And is it fair to describe that role as you will essentially represent the film, find an appropriate distributor for that film?
Yep.
Is it much more to it than that? Am I missing?
I think that really crystallizes it in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think there is yes and no, you know, but I think that actually really crystallizes it.
Mm-hmm. In some cases, when you have a buzz around the film, then it becomes kind of like selling a hot property, like an apartment where you have people bidding in a way, and you're kind of navigating that. Or
yeah, sometimes. I mean, that's a good feeling. I feel more often it's like I'm hoping it's going to become that, you know, or trying to get it to that place.
Well, of course, that's the hope.
But you know that. I mean, I think we're here because of a project that was just like that, you know, because Alex kind of introduced us, and that that project was a little bit like that, and that was, you know, it's a great feeling when there's, you know, it's funny though, as a sales agent, you know, I'm really, you know, part of what you do is you gotta kind of pay attention to. Of course, you want to get the best deal for your client and everything, but you also got to pay attention to how you manage the acquisitions people.
Mm-hmm.
So I've actually had the sensation where I've had a movie that 7 or 8 people wanted where I've been like, oh, my God, what is, like, you know, Tom, Dick, and Harry who don't get it? Like, what are they going to think about, like, you have to land the plane the right way with the acquisitions people who want it, who don't get it.
Right.
And so you got
to
be.
You have to maintain relationships.
Yeah,
you
got to be careful about that. And the clients don't think about that.
You
know?
Right now, yeah. I never even considered that, yeah. that you would be in a position where you have to say, no, they're going to be disappointed. These are distributors that want a particular film.
Yeah.
Not going to get it. And they're going to take it personally because, of course, there's a sense of ownership and of pride around their company and what they feel like they can do for the film and why it's a good match. And, of course, they're betting that it will make money for them as well. And then you're, you know, taking it off the table.
Yeah. And, I mean, sometimes it'll be like they're, you know, I always tell potential clients that you know, it kind of depends on the company. Some companies I deal with the boss. Other companies I deal with the young guy.
Yeah.
But most, like, I tend to deal with somebody in between. Like, it seems like the VP level or something tends to be the guy I'm dealing with. But, you know, that guy may have advocated it to his boss and gone and got the formal offer. So they've kind of got some skin
in the game.
In the game. So, you know, if you're... Because you're always in this position at the beginning where you're like, look at this, this is great, you got to take it. And then you get, you know, four or five people interested, and you're like, well, then you're like coy.
Yeah.
I don't know if coy, like, I'm not coy, I'm not really coy with them, I'm pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
But you're, you know, you just got to be...
You can't give them an answer.
So yeah, you got to be as straight with them right. and at the same time as possible, and at the same time, you know... ultimately work for your clients, but I think I've managed to be pretty straight with them. You know, I think if you asked around about me, people would tell you that. So don't take it from me. I had a great experience. Are we on?
Yeah.
Okay. I had a great experience at Fantastic Fest with the film I was just talking about, where I said something to a guy that I don't think I'd really ever said before, which was a distributor. Hey, what's going on with that? And I was like, man, I don't think you can afford it. And I was like, okay.
I said it in a joking way.
And okay. Then, you know, when he figured out the companies that were interested, he knew that anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, but it was, that was a good feeling.
You got him in a horror, like a distributor that specializes in genre, right? Didn't you?
Me?
Did you? I'm asking.
Oh, not really. No,
for a Calvo's film?
Oh, the distributor is.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay. What were you talking about with this guy that you said you couldn't afford? Was it another distributor interested in that film?
Yeah, it was another distributor that was interested in that film.
Okay.
So,
Well, you got them a genre distributor, or they have one, which seems to be...
Yeah, no, it's a great...
Did you broker
that? It's a great
that?
Situation. I did, yeah.
Because that seems to me a great example where... You're doing a really good. You're doing the right thing. Perhaps another distributor might even offer something a more, you know, attractive in different ways. But can they? Do they have the functions to really make the film succeed in the right way? You know, because you know, do they know how to handle a particular type of genre film or what have you?
Yeah, and it's always also so sort of palpable when you have, like, for me as the sales agent, like, I can feel their hunger for it and their, you know, whether they're truly excited about it or whether it's sort of like, yeah, this works for our model. We can just, you know, put it in our, you know, put it in our, what's the word? I don't know.
Factory line.
Yeah, our factory, our conveyor belt or whatever.
Yeah, because it's got the, right, and right, put it, this, it's sort of a round peg and a round
I felt like, and then what often happens is I'll impress that upon the clients, like, I think these guys are really into it, I think they really care about it, and then they, you know, usually there'll be a phone call with the distributors that are interested, and that kind of comes through, so a lot of times it's self-evident to the clients that, you know, this is the place that's going to be the right fit for my film. You know, I mean, this is, again, in that situation where you have one or two places, you know, or a handful of places that want it. But you know, I think often they can, I think 9 times out of 10, I'll agree with the decision the clients make and think they went with, you know, the right place.
Right. A thoughtful, intelligent filmmaker, producer, what have you, is going to have a vision. Mm-hmm. And they're going to also just, their hairs on their arms are going to be in the neck. They have a vision for, like, oh, who is the ideal distributor? They've been thinking about it potentially since they started the project, you know?
Yeah. That's not so always.
If I'm thinking, like, who this they is, get, I'm making this film, and this just screams oscilloscope.
Yeah.
This just screams.
That's the one they always want, by the way. the guy's I rep.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Remind me to email this part of the clip to Oscilloscope.
Oh, yeah. I just actually ran into the yesterday in the park into one of the Oscilloscope guys.
Yeah,
I know they just moved their offices.
Greenpoint, I mean to Williamsburg.
Yeah,
yeah.
So what is there? What's your sweet spot as far as like a film? Is there a size? Is there a particular sensibility to a film that is for Bill Strauss?
Well, I think there's, you know, what I've done and what I'd like to be doing, to be honest, you know, like I'd like to be getting the cast driven stuff in dramatic competition at Sundance, you know, and, you know, the top stuff at Toronto with Ryan Gosling or something in it.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, but that's not happening at this point, but I still believe I'm growing something. So that's, you know, that's. You know, who knows?
Are you a one-man operation?
I'm a one-man operation, yeah. And so I'm really boutique for that reason. Your question, I like directors, you know. I think I'm just drawn to directors that I think are really talented. And so I really look for... You know, I just think like often they're like younger, I think talented, new people. I mean, I'm definitely taking on a lot of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that is kind of my sweet spot has kind of been young auteurs so far, I think. But
sort of the Alex Ross Perrys of the world, even though that.
Yeah, well. Before they're Alex Ross Perrys, yeah, sort of, it seems like.
Yeah.
Like I had like one of the first guys I ever repped was Ben Dickinson, mm-hmm. First Winter. Yeah.
Been on the show a couple of times.
Oh, no kidding. Okay, mm-hmm. Cool.
Did you work First Winter?
I did First Winter. Yeah. And creative control I did not get, but I tried. But
don't kill any animals.
Right. Yeah, that was interesting. And that was like my, you know, I hadn't really repped films before, and mm-hmm. So I didn't.
Did you go to see it at Tribeca and picked it up there? Is that what happened?
It was a connection.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember who hooked me up with Zach, who was the producer. I feel bad. I should remember this. Oh yeah, this woman Diana Williams, who now like works for Lucasfilms, but at the time,
right.
Didn't.
And so you're saying, and you didn't work with him with creative control again, or?
No, I tried, but I think it was different producers. Zach was the EP. I think he tried for me, mm-hmm. but I think it was ultimately his decision.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Joel Petroikis, you know, I did him.
Yeah,
I did Buzzard.
I was texting with him Tuesday night.
Saying, yeah, Joel's great.
What's going on over there?
Yeah.
It was like, guys, really? Guys, what's happening?
I was thinking about him, actually.
Yeah,
as I was watching.
I have one other friend who has a film festival in Michigan, and I was texting with him as well.
Yeah.
The two of them, and I was just, and they were both so defeated.
Yeah.
But I can't talk about it yet.
Yeah, I'll get too depressed getting into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the other hat you wear quite frequently, or at least to some degree anyway, is a producer. I don't know if people listening know, but you were one of the producers on Straight Outta Compton, right? So that had to be an amazing opportunity for you.
Yeah, that was the residue of my earlier professional life, basically.
Okay.
But I was I grew up in Brooklyn, so went out to LA for film school for college, and then pretty much, other than a few years back here, always wanted to move back here. Other than a few years back here, was pretty much out there my whole adult life, and kind of started in the studio system. Actually, originally as a writer, and mm-hmm. then kind of switched sides and worked at New Line. I was an executive at New Line for a while,
mm-hmm.
and in L.A. And then I went into producing I got, you know, like all executives do, the new studio head comes in and the old guard goes out. That's and right. I was one of those casualties. My thing was, like, when I was a kid and I'm in my 40s, late 40s, I was a hip-hop head in the early 80s in New York and used to go to all the famous hip-hop clubs, and that really sort of informed my professional taste.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always looking for that nexus of Hollywood and hip-hop culture.
Okay.
And so, like, at New Line, I was, you know, I would meet with, like, Red and Method Man or Nick Cannon or, you know, like, those kind of guys were the, you know, Mike Epps. To this day, I'm still tight with that, you know, like, so that was sort of my thing. So it was a you know, it was always elevated, though, I guess, although Red and Method Man's things aren't necessarily elevated, but I guess something really funny, too, like the Wayans brothers, I had one thing with them for a while. Jamie Foxx, I had a thing with. But that was, it, you know, but, you know, the one that I remember that hurts the most that didn't happen is, like, we were close to getting Menace to Society, a sequel.
Oh, really?
About, like, O-Dog coming back as a, like, an older guy who's just a bad influence on a new group of kids, like, getting out of jail. And so that was, like, my sweet spot as a producer/executive was, like, that $10 million gritty film that makes urban meets hip-hop, maybe, film that makes $30 or $40 million. So when I went to producing, it was sort of a, this is so far from indie stuff, but maybe, I don't, but it was sort of a natural thing that the agents would send me the kind of, that kind of material, and they sent me Straight out of Compton. And I was, that was, you know, in some ways, ironically, what set me off on the whole indie thing, I kind of fell in love with the indie world right around that time, because it was the first time I went to Sundance, and I was staying with 40 Acres and a Mule guys. And I told them, hey, I just got this script about NWA. And they were like, don't waste your time. We tried it. Cube tried it. I got to be careful about saying Cube tried it, but whatever. Brian Grazer tried it. Somebody else. Some big a lot of big people had tried it, and nobody else had been able to get the music rights. This what said. You'll never get the music rights.
Right.
And then me and
Is that important?
Yeah, you couldn't do the NWA movie without the the rights. Yeah, right. You're joking.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
No.
But that was kind of kind of what what me and my partner on it, this guy, there's a company Circle of Confusion where I went to from New Line, and I was working with them. And my partner on it, this guy, David Engel, and I, we spent 2 years basically developing the script in such a way, and also kind of playing the 6 degrees of separation game, where we got to Easy's widow, who was the woman who wouldn't give them to anybody. And we ended up, you know, with a lot of help from one of the writers who was the guy who kind of had a connection to her, or like a connection to a connection to a connection. We ended up getting the music rights, and that was 2004 that I first got
it. Oh my gosh.
And so 2006, we sold it back to New Line. It went through numerous rewrites, numerous deals had to be, producer deals had to be put in place. It took like 3 years to get all the producer deals in place. And the movie got made, you know, the movie then went from New Line to Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers absorbed New Line, and then it went to Universal in like 2012. And and then they, you know, we made it in 2014. But my real contribution in a very, like, I think, you know, anybody kind of out there who knows the real story knows that what we did in getting the rights was sort of an indispensable thing that we did.
Well, yeah, that would, again, yeah.
But I wasn't really that involved in making the movie, I
understand.
Should say. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I think that...
But I went out to set, and they were nice to me. You know, I spent a couple days out there.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
Did you get to go to the Oscars? Or?
No, but that was not... I don't know that I would have wanted to, given the way it all went down. But, you know.
That's right. Well, no, I would say that's justification for getting a producer credit. The film wouldn't have been... You couldn't have made it, like you said, before, without the music.
Yeah, no,
it is about music.
Yeah, no, I mean...
If you look at a couple of other cases, like where... Todd Haynes couldn't get David Bowie music, couldn't get Karen Carpenter, but, you know, that was a different thing for a short, you know, and things like that. But sometimes you can manage to make it, but it's a different situation. You're talking about a film of this scale.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, and about, in a way, the origin story of this music group and and their first album and the impact that had.
So yeah.
You know, culturally, so it's a little different.
Yeah. No, I mean, you there was no movie
right
without the music.
Yeah.
And we sold it, and we developed it to such a place that it would sell. So we did a couple of things. Like my David, he made what I thought was a good analogy, which was that like if it was a relay race, we kind of ran the first leg, and then Ice Cube and his partner Matt Alvarez kind of ran the second leg in terms of getting it into production. And then there was another guy named Scott Bernstein who was like on the set every day, and he kind of ran the third leg.
I
think we all performed a, you know, valuable
functions.
Yeah. So
interesting. Producing is that something, whichever leg it happens to be for a film, you might serve a different leg depending on the project, I suppose, right? And is that a different criteria for you when you're considering producing than it would be selling?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, I think where I am now is like I came back here in 2011. Are the airplanes bothering people?
No? I don't think
so. I came back in 2011, and the idea was to be a sales agent. I was a little burnt out. I'd been waiting for, 7 years by then?
Yeah.
But now because of Compton, I feel like I'd be an idiot not to try to do some producing stuff again.
Leverage that.
Yeah. So I've got my thing now is my day job is sales, you know, but I want to have two or three passion projects as a producer.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think for those passion projects, I'm still sticking to what was my bread and butter as a producer, you know, which are like still stories about, you know, race has always been interesting to me.
Yes.
And, you know, a little bit gangsters. I've always liked gangsters, you know, so I have one that's about the Chin, Vincent the Chin. Do you know the Chin, Vincent the Chin Gigante, the guy who walked around the village in a bathrobe?
Oh, yeah.
That gang, he was Gotti's rival, so I'm trying to do one about him.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple others that are more like about race, or the Rocksteady crew, who was the first breaking crew in New York in the early 80s, who I personally witnessed as a kid and was like the most exciting thing I've ever seen. I'm trying to figure out how to put that together as a big movie. But so
is there a property or something, like a book?
We have the rights.
Okay. To their
we have
story.
Their life rights.
Oh, that's good.
So those are some of the producing, you know, there's a couple more. One that is kind of about Tupac's legacy, not him himself, but so those are closer to the things that I was always doing as a producer.
Is that a documentary, or is that a...
Oh, and that documentary actually just... I was just out there for AFM, and we met with Tamika, who's Eazy's widow, again, and we're going to do a documentary about Eazy-E, and that's starting to come together with a really good indie filmmaker whose movie I produced that was at Sundance in 2007 named... Actually, this... I should be... It's not a done deal yet, so I should probably... Yeah,
I'll tape. Yeah, off.
But I want him to get the gig.
Who's the person? I'm not gonna. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
You grew up in New York City.
Yeah.
In Manhattan?
Or in Brooklyn Heights.
Oh, you mentioned Brooklyn before.
Yeah.
Oh, in Brooklyn. On the streets of Brooklyn Heights.
Yeah. On the streets of Brooklyn Heights.
I always say when people ask me, and anybody listening to the show knows, I always say I grew up on the mean streets of Forest Hills. You know, I've exhausted that joke.
I think that's a fair analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it must have been still quite a different Brooklyn Heights.
Yeah. I mean, I think Brooklyn Heights in some ways is timeless compared to the rest of Brooklyn.
That's kind of true. There's a lot of wealth there.
Yeah.
And they don't really probably put up with too much development over there.
Yeah.
On the same scale that's going on in other neighborhoods in northern Brooklyn. Yeah.
But it's still different. It is different, you know. Mm-hmm. It's different. It's just strange. It's like all of Brooklyn got colonized or something. And
right.
Especially coming back
it
after
did,
20
by
years.
Wall Street. Yeah.
You know, it's kind of. I have mixed feelings about it.
I'm sure. Where do you live now? I
live right on the edge of Brooklyn Heights in Dumbo.
Okay. So you live there. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's sort of right there on the edge.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
What's the What's your next move here? Are you are you going to any festivals in the next?
Yeah, I'll go to Sundance. I mean, I'll be. I don't have a movie there mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. I think 3 of the last 4 years I've had things there. Mm-hmm. You know, some more memorable than others. And, you know, there's a couple films at Doc NYC. Even though it started today, I'm still talking to a couple films there.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I'll have something at South by Southwest. And, you know, Berlin is a little... I went there once and sold a film out of there once. But I don't... It's not like my normal... You know, normally I'll go to Sundance, South by, Hot Docs.
Not Telluride.
What's that?
Telluride?
No, I don't go to Telluride. I go to Toronto normally.
Summer lately. Okay.
I've started going to Fantasia the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. I skipped Toronto this year because I did IFP and the Film Week and Fantastic Fest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like to do all 3 of those in a row is brutal.
Okay.
And I really like Fantastic Fest. So, you know, AFM, my go-to.
I've been wanting to go to that, yeah.
Fantastic Fest is great, but it's getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
It's starting to outgrow its venue.
Oh, yeah.
But it's exciting in a way. There's an intimacy to it, too, that's great.
Yeah.
Hot Docs is great, too. I actually like the sort of, you know, specialized festivals that are sort of top tier in their specialty.
Well, I mean, the quality, no matter what you see, is probably going to be quite good.
Yeah, the programming's great at Fantastic Fest, actually.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah.
That's great. Yeah, they have some top people there. Yeah, I had that experience at True False as well.
I haven't gone. That's definitely on my very curious thinking about it.
Yeah, try to make that.
Yeah.
But it's not. They cater completely to filmmakers. I mean, it's a filmmakers festival. It's not a sales. It's not a. They don't do anything. There's no competition. There's no like awards. There's no. They pay fees to all the filmmakers as a rule. They're, you know, it's a real pro filmmaker. You know, some festivals are more interested. They're about the sales, and some are really press and trying to get as much press and friendlier. And then, but this one is they really. Look after the filmmakers there, and that's why the documentary filmmakers love that place.
Yeah,
it's like late February, sometimes over that last weekend of February. Yeah, it's right before South by.
Yeah, maybe I should go.
Yeah, I'd love to go back. Listen, thank you so much for doing this.
Okay,
I'd like to do it again. Also,
You
know, I think we barely scratched the surface.
Maybe, yeah.
Thank you, Bill.
Yep.
Okay, everybody, thank you for listening to episode number 382 of the podcast. We have lots of great stuff coming up in the next few weeks. I've been posting a little more frequently than I used to or have been for a while, but I think we're going to try to slow it down again to once a week. It's quite a lot of work to work at the pace I've been doing it, but it is a pleasure. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting the podcast. FilmWax Radio is part of the Showbiz Studios podcast network. And we're presented by Rooftop Films. Please do take care of yourself and the ones you love. And we'll be back soon. Thanks. Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads. Sleeping in broken beds, ain't no use jiving.
this fool.